Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. American Indians make up less than 1% of the population, yet Indian names and images are everywhere, as mascots of professional sports teams, logos on butter packaging, also on military equipment. Sometimes it's irreverent, even racist. A new exhibit at the Smithsonian explores the misconceptions about that Native American imagery. This hour, On Point, Native Americans tell their stories. You can join us on air or online. Are you Native American? How do you see the portrayal of American Indians in our society? Join us at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we're talking about Native Americans in popular music. But first, joining me now from Washington are the co-curators of Americans at the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian. Paul Chott Smith is associate curator at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. He's a member of the Comanche tribe and author of Everything You Know About Indians Is Wrong. Paul Chott Smith, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane.
And Cecile Gantome, associate curator at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. She's the author of Officially Indians, Symbols That Define the United States. Cecile, great to have you.
Hello, Jane.
Listeners, we have got a gallery of images from the Smithsonian exhibit at our website, onpointradio.org. Paul and Cecile, tell us what inspired this exhibit at the Smithsonian. Paul?
Well, we opened our museum in 2004 here on the National Mall, and since then we've learned a great deal about what the public knows, what they're looking for from our museum. And we gave a lot of thought to what this exhibition might be, and we built it on this paradox, which is most Americans in 2018, they don't live in areas where there are lots of Native people. Tens of millions of Americans never see Indians at all. And yet they're surrounded by Indian imagery, place names, advertising throughout their lives. Americans play Indian as children. Americans reperform the original Thanksgiving meal, you know, every year.
Right.
So we felt it could be powerful to kind of bring that to the surface and have visitors sort of encounter how much they're connected to these imaginary Indians and the powerful emotional force they have on people's lives, even though most Americans don't think they're thinking about Indians.
Mm. The symbol of American Indian heritage has been used to sell everything from Land O'Lakes butter to typewriters and airplanes. We've got military equipment. You say that the American Indian has become a kind of national mascot. Cecile, tell us how and why that did happen.
Well, this phenomenon started before the founding of the country. It actually started with the Patriots, who used a symbol of an American Indian to represent their most cherished political value, liberty. With the founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson in particular, he used an image of an Indian to represent the United States of America. And the symbol has been used in various ways by Americans throughout the history of the country. But after World War I, when modern advertising really took off, the thing is that commercial artists, graphic artists, were able to capitalize on the imagery of the Plains Indian warrior as a symbol of the American West and what that represented for Americans, which was rugged individualism, the pioneer spirit. In other words, it represented the American spirit. Mm. And as I say, commercial artists were actually able to capitalize and literally monetize that image. Mm.
Here's a famous public service announcement that became known as the Crying Indian ad. Speaking of advertisement, the anti-litter organization Keep America Beautiful launched the ad in 1971 and featured Iron Eyes Cody, an actor in Native American garb with a single tear rolling down his face as trash from someone littering is thrown to his feet.
Some people have a deep, abiding respect for the natural beauty that was once this country. And some people don't. People start pollution. People can stop it.
Paul, so many Americans are fascinated by American Indians, conflicted. Certainly we're shaped by American Indians, as you have described. What are we getting wrong about Native Americans, about American Indians?
Well, a lot of things. When I first started writing about this a couple of decades ago now, it was easy to be very dismissive and just point out how inaccurate it is. But I think, you know, we need to give the public some credit. I think they understand these images are not exact representations. I don't think when you look at the Butter Maiden at Land O'Lakes, you're saying, gee, is she from this particular tribe, and how accurate is that? I think we're very used to all those representations. And what I think it shows is a kind of profound ambivalence on the part of the public, which sort of understands the whole country doesn't exist or exists in a really different way without American Indians. And that, what do we make of this, that the National Project involves dispossession of Native people? So rather than pointing out that, okay, the symbol you see for the Washington NFL team, that that's not like all Indians or something else, what we really became interested in is exploring why people are so passionate about that and the role that it plays in people's lives. And what you find out is this imagery is useful. Like Iron Eyes Cody, not an Indian, incidentally, his use is to support an anti-pollution campaign, the use to give a name of a tribe for a helicopter for the U.S. military. So there are all these ways the idea of Indians are useful, which, of course, is not the actual Indian people
around. We should note that the Indian in that campaign, or the so-called Indian in that campaign, the anti-litter campaign in 71, the actor was actually not an American Indian, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So you mentioned the NFL and the Washington Redskins. I mean, the Cleveland Indians are doing away with their longtime mascot, the notorious Chief Wahoo. That's going away next year. What do you make of that? I mean, people have emotional connections to these logos, and yet, you know, some of them are not terribly, well, downright racist. They're caricatures, right?
Yeah, and I come at it from a sports fan, and what I think about is fans didn't choose the name of the team, the mascot, an owner did in another century. When people like me come along and say, gee, that's, you know, a dictionary-defined slur, in the case of the DC NFL team, you know, they react because we're taking away something that's precious to them. But they didn't, they're not fans because of the name. If it was the Washington Eagles and the Philadelphia Redskins, I mean, do you think the fan bases would be very different? That's not why people got involved. So the decision by the Cleveland Indians and Major League Baseball, really significant, a real turning point, because it's acknowledging, you know, what we thought was appropriate and okay decades ago no longer is. Let's get with the times. Let's get on the right side of history. But, you know, personally, I follow the National League, but the Cleveland Indians have been my favorite American League team the last several years, mm-hmm. an exciting team to watch. And I'll be able to watch them more enthusiastically now that I'm not going to have to look at Chief Wahoo quite so much.
Here's a longtime Indians fan. His name's John Reap. This is an interview with Cleveland.com expressing his feelings about the Indians getting rid of Chief Wahoo. That logo will be gone in the 2019 season.
I think it's a terrible decision to get rid of the Chief. I've been a Cleveland fan for 55 years and lived in this city for my whole life. And go Tribe, Wahoo.
Let's get Charles in here from Kenosha, Wisconsin. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. How you doing?
Hi, I'm well. Go ahead.
This is something that's sort of dear to my heart and kind of stuck in my craw for a while. I'm from Oshkosh originally.
Okay.
And I went to a high school that was Oshkosh West, and our mascot was the Oshkosh West Indians. Now, the city of Oshkosh is named after Chief Oshkosh. It's in Winnebago County. It's the county seat of Winnebago, which is an Indian name. The largest park in Oshkosh is Menominee Park, which is, of course, an Indian name. And due to political pressure, and our mascot was a very stoic looking Indian head with a war bonnet. And, you know, we've venerated our heritage through this, and now we've become, because of public pressure, and I can totally understand Washington Redskins and things like that, but I mean, now we're the Oshkosh West Wildcats, and as far as I know, there's not any cats at all, wild or otherwise, that I've ever seen in Oshkosh.
Charles, thank you. Cecile, I want you to jump in here. I appreciate your call, Charles. It's just a great point. Cecile, some fans suggest, you know, you're taking this a little too far. They don't see the disrespect. They see history.
Yeah. Well, we certainly understand that people have both personal and family connections to their sports teams and to the team mascots. But one of the issues involved in this is the imagery that we see of American Indians that's pervasive in American life is 99% of the time Indians from the past. And that is actually detrimental because Americans have always placed American Indians in the past. They've never regarded them as contemporaries. And putting American Indians in the past and saying that they're not quite equal to their white brethren is part of what allowed Americans to usurp American Indian lands.
Paul, how would you add to that? What would you say to our caller, Charles?
I'm sure Charles knows how often the name Blackhawk is in these states as well, and it's, you know, laundromats, movie theaters, every kinds of things. And I think before we get to be too prescriptive about which is appropriate, which isn't, I think it's first useful to look at how pervasive it is and how unique that is as a phenomenon.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
You've probably heard about this Russia investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Every day there's a new headline about it. Well, Embedded is back with two episodes that lay the whole thing out, start to finish, so the news makes sense. Listen on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. That's a scene from the 1956 Western The Searchers, featuring John Wayne about an American Civil War veteran on a journey to rescue his niece from Comanche Indians. We are talking this hour about a new exhibit at the Smithsonian and a big rethink about Native American history and their influence on American culture today. You can join the conversation. How has America been shaped by its relationship with American Indians? From Pocahontas to the Trail of Tears to the Battle of Bighorn, Little Bighorn, do we know the truth? Follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook, On Point Radio. Speaking of Pocahontas, here's the 1995 Disney version of the film. Popularizes the myth that Pocahontas, the Native American princess, fell in love with Englishman John Smith during the height of conflict between English settlers and the indigenous people of the Americas. Here's the scene just after Pocahontas throws herself on John Smith's body to prevent her father from executing him.
If you kill him, you'll have to kill me too.
Daughter, stand back.
I won't! I love him, father. Look around you. This is where the path of hatred has brought us. This is the path I choose, Father. What will yours be?
My guests today are Paul Chott-Smith, a member of the Comanche tribe, and Cecile Gantome. They are co-curators of Americans at the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian. So, Paul Chott-Smith, set us straight here, a little bit of Hollywood in there. Not so much the truth. Pocahontas and John Smith were never really in love, I guess, right?
No, she fell in love, maybe, or he fell in love with her. It was a different John, John Rolfe, a tobacco planter. And there's not been much dispute that that story never really happened that way. People have known for hundreds of years it didn't happen quite that way. But it's so compelling that it keeps emerging. Mm-hmm. And historians and experts and Native Americans all point out it's not actually true. But it has incredible staying power. And, of course, most Americans today know about Pocahontas from the Disney film you played the clip from. And in the exhibition, what people will see is, you know, Pocahontas is actually a really formidable person who was famous on two continents by the time she was in her early 20s. When she married Rolfe, something followed called the Pocahontas Peace, this alliance between the English and the Powhatan Indians. And, you know, a very significant figure, which is quite different than this version of Pocahontas. And mm-hmm. what you further find is Americans have been dreaming and musing and ruminating about Pocahontas basically every generation during her lifetime and after. So it's interesting that she's such a large figure in American national consciousness.
Indeed. I mean, she was depicted three times in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol building, more than any other historical figure. It's fascinating. Cecile Gantome, take us inside this exhibit. There's a visually powerful central gallery where visitors find themselves surrounded by objects and images from three centuries of American Indian life. Give us a sense of what we see there.
What you see when you walk in is a large gallery that's about 120 feet long, and three of the walls are covered floor to ceiling with images of American Indians from Americans' everyday lives, from corporate logos, military insignia, advertising, product design, emblems of national identity, and as well TV and the movies. It's imagery that people recognize from their own life, that they can easily recognize from their grandparents' life, and they know that is part of their children's lives.
And listeners, we've got a great gallery of images from this Smithsonian exhibit at our website, onpointradio.org. I've got so many callers here. Let me get Martha in from Asheville, North Carolina. Hi, Martha. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Of course.
I'm American Indian, and I'm not offended by this. I think in our society we've gone way too far with everybody's offended by everything. And I understand your points, but it'd take Charles, the caller that called in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's part of history, and I don't think the lady that's your guest there, I don't think she gets it. And I don't think she understands what he's talking about is history, and that this was all of these names of different places in his town are named for Native Americans. And I think that's more respectful that they're naming these places after a chief.
Mm-hmm. And Martha, let me get Cecile in here. Too much political correctness, Martha says. Push back on that, Cecile.
Yes, well, I didn't mean to come across quite that way. We are not taking the position that all of this imagery is wrong and that it's politically incorrect and it's all appropriation and it's all stereotypes. I mean, it does exist because of the history that Americans and American Indians share, and the fact that there are place names throughout what is today the United States that are actually Native names is a wonderful thing. And people should be reminded of the indigenous people that are the primary Americans, the first Americans, by all means.
Martha, thanks for the call and for bringing that up. You know, there's a historical element to this exhibit at the Smithsonian, and really a remembrance of painful times in American history for American Indians. The Trail of Tears explores the Indian Removal Act of 1830, which was signed by Andrew Jackson. It was the forced relocation of Cherokee and indigenous Indian people to the West in the 1830s. Paul, remind us, thousands died during that long journey west in terrible internment camps as well.
Yeah, it was a catastrophe for not just the Cherokee, but other tribes of the Southeast, and actually other tribes even beyond the Southeast. And what we saw the opportunity here was to really talk about how, rather than it being one very bad man, President Jackson, it was a national debate around the Indian Removal Act. And Indian leaders had agency, and they had allies on their side. And we really are asking visitors to look at it as a national decision versus one awful thing a few people did. So I think that'll be revelatory. And I think it'll also be interesting to see how profound it was in the history of the country. It's often seen as a story of some Indians being victimized when, in fact, it helped explode the Cotton Kingdom and created enormous wealth. And the country sort of knew what it was doing. So it'll be new to many people who think they're pretty familiar with the story.
Mm. Let's get Mike in here from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Enjoy the conversation.
Thank you.
I'll tell you a story that shocked and saddened me from my youth. I grew up in Missouri, and my high school logo was a warrior. And about 30 years ago, I lived in Arizona for about 8 years. At about age 20, I moved to Arizona from Missouri. And what I saw out there, a lot of people should see. There were reservations. Now, Missouri, I wasn't aware of reservations in Missouri. There might have been. The thing I remember most growing up was Indian mounds were in Missouri, and they were dug up, the relics were taken, and so on and so on. Everybody knew about them. But when I moved to Arizona, what I saw out there shocked me. The reservations, this was the image that I saw. All along the edge of the reservation was liquor stores. And in the morning, when you drove by, the line would be down the street waiting for them to open. If you went into a store, like a convenience store, any kind of a Hostess product, any kind of a sweet carb-type product, they couldn't keep it on the shelf. The houses had no trash pickup. The back of every house was giant mounds of trash. I was shocked. I couldn't believe this, that in that day and time, grant you it was 30 years ago, that this was the situation that I was witnessing down there.
Oh. Mike, thanks so much for the call. Paul Chott-Smith, you're from the Comanche tribe. I mean, what Mike describes is another image of American Indians that many people do have. And it is reality, I guess, to some extent.
Yeah, there are a lot of challenges in Indian country. I think in the United States, there's been a lot of very positive change in the last 30 years. But certainly there are a lot of very difficult circumstances that face American Indians today.
Mike, thanks so much for the call. Here's Dean in Tampa. Hi, Dean. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just heard the gentleman's comment. I want you to know I'm African American, and I am an artist. And I have been fortunate to be in a lot of shows out west at the Cowboy Hall, the Autry. And I have done a series of paintings on those reservations out in Phoenix.
Mm.
And part of it was because I grew up poor. I grew up in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never gone to a reservation. A friend of mine took me out there. And I was just dumbfounded. Mm-hmm. And I said, this is what I shall paint. Because I relate it to the psychological space. I understand that poverty. And as I began to paint a series of these paintings and introduce them into the West, the collectors, they walk by them like, it's a ghost.
Mm-hmm.
It's depressing. They don't want to see it. And I thought, but can we have this conversation?
Mm.
So it wasn't about trying to point guilt. It was just trying to say, hey, there's something drastically wrong here.
Mm.
And as a visual artist, I cannot hardly sell them. They're stacking up in my studio. I get rave reviews about them, but nobody wants them.
Mm.
When I go out there, there's a lot of romanticism that, you know, that sells well and this kind of stuff. But when you're trying to have a serious conversation about the history and trying to bring it into contemporary culture, they don't seem to want to have the conversation. I kind of wonder why. Is it because of the romanticism of television? Or is it, you know, what is it?
Yeah.
What is
it? Dean, thank you. It's a good question. Kind of what we're trying to do here today, and certainly what you're trying to do at the Smithsonian, Cecile. What would you say to our caller, Dean?
Well, yes, it is part of what we're trying to demonstrate, that in valorizing and romanticizing American Indians and in creating this imagery of imaginary Indians, it does serve in a way as a sort of impenetrable curtain that keeps Americans from knowing who American Indians really are.
Let's get Joe in here from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, June.
Hi.
I'm an historian, and I guess I'll start off by saying that if anybody's ever read the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson speaks of Native people as savages, complains to George III, who's the main character he's speaking to, as exposing his European colonists to the horrors of these savages. The early government of the United States, they made many treaties that they broke, all of them. The only desire they had was to really move the native population further and further west. And there are so many episodes, the 49ers, for example, in California when they arrived. By the time they had left the area in California, they had virtually murdered all of the native population in the area. And when they went north for the Fraser River Gold Rush in the 1850s, that is in British Columbia, mm-hmm. Canada, one of the first things they noticed was the number of native populations in that area. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, we can solve your problem. We can kill them. And they said, well, we don't kill our native population. My mother was a legal secretary, and mm-hmm. the man who, he told me this story, he would have been about 130 today if he were alive,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but he grew up in the Dakota Territories, and as a young child, about 6 or 7, his uncle took him to a saloon. I mean, it was one of these, I guess, frontier towns, where the saloon was the only place you could get a drink. And so he's sitting there, a young child, and all of a sudden a native person comes through the swinging doors on horseback. And he said the next thing he saw, the bartender took a rifle, shot the native person dead. Someone led the horse out and dragged the body out. And people just kept on drinking. Somebody had just swatted a fly. I mean, I think the problem in this country is, you know, the adage, the only good Indian is a dead Indian, is that we've had this long, long history of putting the native population on reservations where we don't have to bother with them anymore.
Joe, thank you for the call. Paul Chodd-Smith, I mean, certainly there are stories like that, and Joe tells one. But to some extent, Indians are somewhat frozen in a period of time with the headdress and the warrior in buckskin. You know, how did those images become the stereotypical American Indian?
Yeah, when you really step back, it's pretty crazy because, for example, after Little Bighorn, this huge defeat by the U.S., famous Civil War general and 200 of his men wiped out, some of the combatants very soon are then touring with the Wild West shows of Cody. Sitting Bull goes on a lecture tour. These people become like great Americans. And when you think about it, it's really crazy. Like, how did that happen? So, you know, there's this relationship between, you know, I think the U.S. national consciousness and American Indians that is really, we think, something to behold. And I think it plays out in the present as well, that the country is fascinated, shaped, conflicted, trying to make sense of these things. And it's an ongoing process.
Here's an episode from the first season of the Netflix show, The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. We get a look into the early life of Jacqueline White, played by Jane Krakowski. Here's a flashback scene where Jacqueline tells her parents she does not identify with being American Indian.
We didn't say anything when you dyed your hair and when you got blue contact lenses, or even when you started saying things like neato and tennis.
It's how white people talk, Mom. Oy, gewalt.
But Manhattan?
I'm sorry, but I don't want to live my whole life in Bear Creek, South Dakota. It's 1992, and nothing has changed in this country. If you want to get anywhere, you need to be blonde and white.
But you're an Indian, Jackie Lynn.
God, Dad, saying Indian is offensive now.
Paul Chodd-Smith, how do we reconcile this Native American history without erasing the images of the past?
Well, I don't think there's any one quick solution. What we think is American people will see that Americans have these deeper connections than they thought. And even if it was being in the Campfire Girls, you know, even if it's going to a school with an Indian name, how did all that come about? What is going on there? So we sort of stay away from this idea there's one panacea that will fix everything. We think it's part of a longer, more interesting discussion. And if people come to our exhibition, I think they'll be surprised at how much fun they're going to have learning about this, learning about themselves, seeing themselves in a lot of the artifacts in the show.
About 10 seconds left. Cécile Gantome, the exhibit at the Smithsonian will run for about 5 years in D.C. What do you hope visitors will come away with?
Well, we want our visitor to see that the history that Americans and American Indians share has had a profound and a lasting effect not only on American Indians, but on Americans themselves.
Well, Cécile Gantome and Paul Chott-Smith, thank you so much. They are co-curators at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. Great to have you with us. Thank you so much for an insightful and interesting conversation and for your insights. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next, listeners, the beat of Native Americans in pop music. That's next. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Those notes, those powerful guitar chords, are from the 1958 song Rumble by Link Wray. Ray's bold style influenced Slash from Guns N' Roses and the godfather of punk, Iggy Pop. Ray had another legacy that wouldn't be recognized till much later. He was an American Indian. He's just one of the many influential Native American musicians featured in the documentary Rumble. You can join the conversation from Jimi Hendrix to the Native American band Redbone. Which American Indian musicians influenced you? Are you an American Indian musician yourself? We want to hear from you. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Austin, Texas, is Stevie Salas, executive producer of the documentary Rumble, The Indians Who Rocked the World, which was released last year. He's a Native American guitarist from the Apache tribe who's worked with the likes of Mick Jagger, Justin Timberlake, and more. Stevie Salas, welcome to On Point. How nice to have you.
It's nice to be had.
So you also had an exhibit at the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian, which eventually became this documentary, right? Tell us about it.
Yeah, today's Smithsonian Day, it looks like. It's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, I was working on this idea of featuring these heroes and not sure quite how to do it. And one day I met a guy called Tim Johnson, who was the co-director of the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian, and I told him about this story. And before I knew it, I was working in D.C. and New York creating an exhibit with him and the Smithsonian, and it was called Up Where We Belong, Natives and Popular Culture. And it was supposed to be a little short little thing. You know, the Smithsonian didn't really want to do it. They didn't quite get it. You know, they're used to doing exhibits on more traditional style things. You know, certainly not doing an exhibit about the drummer of Ozzy Osbourne, Randy Castillo, you know. So we had to kind of push it through. But it became hugely popular, and after its run, we decided to make a film. Mm.
So there are huge names in this film, from Slash and Iggy Pop to Tony Bennett, Martin Scorsese, and more, all talking about the American Indian influence on music. So it's really a documentary about American Indians and the people inspired by their music, right?
Yeah, and the reason, you know, people always sort of, they get confused. They go, I didn't know Tony Bennett was a Native American, and he's not a Native American. But why all those people are in the film is because we wanted to tell a story and not make it a race story. We wanted to tell a story of influence. And if you're going to tell a story of influence and how these Native Americans influenced most of what we know is in music history, I wanted the people who were influenced to tell the story and not musicologists and not, you know, scholars. And that's why there's so many of those guys in the film. Mm.
You're a musician, but you didn't see yourself as an American Indian guitarist. And neither did Link Wray. Link was a huge influence to many guitarists. We just played his song Rumble at the top there. And the documentary features a lot of people talking about what an influence Rumble has had on their careers. Tell us about that song.
Well, if you really think about Rumble, it's 1957, 1958, and this guy comes out and he's playing like he's kind of created the birth of heavy metal, the birth of distorted guitar, the birth of the power chord, and the birth of punk rock all in one thing. And as time went on, he just kept resurfacing. You know, I talk about the three bits of Link Wray. You know, he's like the big bang of rock and roll in the 50s. He kind of disappears for a while he influences Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, Pete Townsend, the Kinks, and everybody else who study him. You forget about him for a while, and then he comes back again in 77, 78 with the birth of punk rock in New York City. And there he is with Robert Gordon and playing in London and Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols, and everybody's checking him out. Then he disappears again, and then he comes back as the go-to cool guy for movie soundtracks for Johnny Depp and Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino and everybody else. So he just keeps coming back. He's the man.
Here is Slash, the lead guitarist from the band Guns N' Roses, in a clip from Rumble, talking about the influence that Link Wray's song Rumble had on his music.
That was the rawest form of the kind of guitar that a lot of the guys that I listened to, is where it started, you know, and it even still sounds better when he does it, you know.
Well, what other musicians were inspired by Link Wray?
Well, you know, it's funny, you go right back to the, like I said, what you would call the Mount Rushmore of rock guitarists. You know, you get Jeff Beck, Pete Townsend, and you have Jimmy Page, you know, all these guys. Even Jimmy Page in the film It Might Get Loud was playing air guitar to Link Wray. You know, Jeff Beck told me one day, and it blew my mind, he said, you know, he goes, Jimmy Page and I, when we were 17, used to jump around in the bedroom at my mom's house playing air guitar to Link Wray. And that visual just blew my mind. And I'm like, people have to know this. People have to know this information.
Then why do you think Link kept his identity a secret?
Well, I know why. Because nobody wanted to be a Native American in the early 1900s through the mid-1900s, it definitely was not a plus. Most people, like my birth certificate, my mom and dad put that they were white, and I thought that was really funny when I recently found that, because when I moved to Austin, I had to get my birth certificate. And it was because they thought it would give me a better shot at life, and I think that, you know, it was only bad things were happening to Native American people in the early 1900s and the mid-1900s, so people never wanted to claim that.
Mm.
Robbie Robertson said in the film, his mother said, you know, be proud of who you are, but be careful who you tell. Mm. And that kind of says it all.
After Link Wray, other musicians embraced their identities. Here's Janie Hendrix, Jimi Hendrix's sister, talking about her brother in the Rumble documentary. Here's what she had to say about Jimi's Cherokee identity.
He was very proud. I mean, he was very proud of being Native and being African-American and being Scottish. It's part of your legacy. It's part of your heritage. It's part of who you are and what you want to reflect and represent.
Mm. The great Jimi Hendrix. How did Jimi Hendrix change the way American Indians could be seen on stage, Steve Salas?
Well, I don't know if you could, I would ever think about that, because, you know, when I was brought up, he was, you know, to all of us, he was an African-American. To all of us, when I was being brought up, Christopher Columbus discovered America. To all of us, when I was being brought up, the Delta Blues was a black art form. You know, there's a lot of things that we were told, and we just assumed to be true. So what's important to me about that statement that Janie made was really is that she says he's proud of his Cherokee heritage, he's proud of his African-American heritage, and he's proud of his Scottish heritage. Because what she's really saying is our country was the flavor of what we became comes from a lot of little areas, a lot of things that were wonderful put together to create something special. And somehow everybody took credit for little bits, and we were taught that's how it was. But to me, that says it all in a nutshell.
Let me get William in here from Boone, North Carolina. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Just had talk a little bit more about Jimi Hendrix and his Native American heritage.
Yeah.
I mean, he's definitely into his African heritage and his Native American heritage. And, you know, he really embraced his Cherokee spirituality, and especially his middle to his end. I mean, he's only a really you know, in the world as an artist for so long. And that really brought in his, you know, where he started going with the music has influenced so much of what we've done with music after that. Mm. And it was so tied into his deeper beliefs. It goes into his clothing, and you could see it on stage, like you were talking about. Mm-hmm. He would wear the jewelry, the turquoise, and all the other things that Native Americans would wear. And he tried to bring that kind of almost like shamanistic flamboyancy to the music. And not everybody knows where he was going with his music after that. I've spoken with Juma Sultan. He was one of the players that played with him for a long time. And he was really trying to get to this next level of bringing this Native American shamanism into the music. And thereby, you know, honestly, has influenced a lot of things since then. But that was a real powerful thing he was fully conscious of and trying to make, you know, the biggest thing in his music.
He was proud of it. Yeah, William, thank you very much. From Jimi Hendrix to another great, Jesse Ed Davis, was known as a masterful American Indian guitarist who died of a drug overdose in the late 80s. Here's archival footage featured in Rumble, in which he talks about his Native American identity before a show with another American Indian musician, John Trudell.
I'm real proud to be playing with John Trudell. I'm real proud to be an Indian. And this is something I hope that doesn't go by you, what we're trying to do.
Jesse Ed Davis, of course, was really an accomplished artist. He played with everyone from Willie Nelson to John Lennon to Rod Stewart. Stevie Salas, tell us how he inspired some of the musicians that he played with.
Well, you know what's funny? There's a couple things about Jesse Ed. First of all, when I first started to, as a hobby, to start to look for other Native American musicians, it's when I was a kid and I was playing guitar for Rod Stewart. And here I was thinking, playing Madison Square Gardens, I can't be the only guy doing this. And I used to see the name Jesse Ed Davis all the time. And it turns out I was actually playing Jesse Ed's guitar parts on some of those Rod Stewart songs and didn't know it while I was searching for Native American guitar players that I thought didn't exist. So, now Jesse Ed is a fascinating story because he was really a catalyst for me wanting to do all of this and how it came, because I was in a recording studio with Rolling Stones in 1994 hanging out, and Ronnie Wood was telling me a story about a guitar, and he said to me, "Stevie, you know who gave me that guitar?" And I'm like, "Who?" And he goes, "Jesse Ed Davis gave me that guitar." And I thought to myself, God, Ronnie just talked about Jesse Ed like he was talking about a superhero, where most people would talk about Ronnie Wood that way, right? So yeah, I thought, people need to know that everyone, people that we think are our heroes, have heroes, and some of those heroes are Native American people. I mean, Eric Clapton, they used to call Eric Clapton God, you know, but Eric Clapton used to get Jesse Ed Davis to play on his records. So I thought to myself, well, what's that make Jesse Ed Davis if Eric Clapton's God, you know, and he wants Jesse Ed? So Jesse Ed is this person that every musician just worshipped. And I thought, God, why doesn't anyone know about this guy?
Back to the documentary Rumble. Here's Native American musician Buffy St. Marie talking about how her anti-war message was blacklisted by the FBI during the Johnson and Nixon administrations.
I was no longer a marginalized person writing Universal Soldier or talking about Native American issues in a coffee house. All of a sudden, I was talking about those things in big-time television. And all of a sudden, everything disappeared. All of a sudden, there was no interest. And it was only 20, 25 years later that in Toronto, a radio broadcaster started an interview by apologizing to me for having gone along with letters written on White House stationery commending them for suppressing my music, which deserved to be suppressed.
Why did that happen, Stevie? And what did it mean for Native Americans making music?
Well, I'm not an expert in all of this because I was a kid during that time, but from what I've learned and just witnessed and from interviewing all these people, you know, people found it to be dangerous for Buffy to be able to say the things she was saying and have people's minds be opened up. You know, nobody wanted to, I guess it was some, how you could find Buffy and her music dangerous is beyond me, but that was pretty much it. They didn't want people to know information, and Buffy was there delivering lots of information.
Let's get Susan in here from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Jane. Well, it's funny, a very timely call. My call was about Buffy St. Marie. I grew up in the 60s. I mean, she was one of my idols, along with, you know, Joni Mitchell, a couple of other people. But with Buffy, you had no, there was no question she was a Native American. She sang. She was so prolific. Her songs were so beautiful. I just, I watched, my son watched her on Sesame Street with her son, Cody. She did so much for Native American awareness and influence. I get choked up just talking about her. I just saw her 5 years ago in Ogunquit, and man, she's still doing it.
She still got it. Yeah. Susan, thank you very much. I want to get Eric in here from Oklahoma City. Hi, Eric. I'm glad you called.
Thanks so much. Yeah. Jessie Davis, of course, very important name here in Oklahoma City. And among the people they played with, and there are many, one that I think probably everybody can relate to is Jackson Browne's debut single, Doctor My Eyes.
Ah,
and Jesse Aid plays the fantastic lead on that song. And as I understand it, he got it on the first take. You might correct me if you know.
Is that right, Stevie Salas?
Yeah. I mean, I interviewed Jackson, and he told the story. Matter of fact, that story's in the film. He walked in, and he did something that I've never heard. I've been a session guitar player for a long time, and I've never heard of somebody doing this, but he walked in, and Jackson played him a song, and Jesse Ed says, "Nah, I can't hear myself on that," and just grabbed his guitar and started to leave. And Jackson goes, wait, let me put up this other song. And he puts up Doctor My Eyes, and Jesse hears it, doesn't even hear the whole song. He hears about 2 minutes of it, says, "Yeah, I think I could play on that." And he walked in. He never listened to the whole song once. He said, "Is that the solo section?" And he goes, "Okay, cue it up." And he didn't even listen how long it was or anything. He played that solo that we all hear, every day on the radio, one time, and that was it. And that was the magic of Jesse Ed.
Ed, thanks so much for the call. So Stevie Salas, the movie Rumble came out last year. What have you heard from people about it?
You know, it's been incredible. It's been a year, and it's still going strong. I was in, Oklahoma this week. I was in Florida this week. It's still playing like crazy. People were talking about it. Everyone says the same thing. I had no idea. How come I didn't know? We played the film. It would be packed in Sydney, Australia. We'd go to Budapest. We'd go to Cannes. It's, packed in Toronto. Everywhere we go, the film's been just packed, and people are just blown away. And I am so amazed by this, because originally we made the film for PBS, and it turned into this massive thing once we won Sundance, and I'm just really grateful.
So I've got 30 seconds here. You wanted this film to be about heroes. What do you hope people walk away with?
I hope that people see, Native people really, I wanted the history to be told. Now, the movie's being put into a school curriculum now, this information, which is great. And I wanted Native American people to know that they have role models out there. They have role models that are not just from 100 and 200 years ago, but these people right here walking the land now, like Buffy St. Marie and Robbie Robertson, that they can be proud of.
Stevie Salas, executive producer of the documentary Rumble, The Indians Who Rock the World. So great to have you, Stevie. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Listeners, we go out with Come and Get Your Love, the 1973 hit from the Native American band Redbone. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.